Our Old Testament reading this morning comes from the book of Isaiah, chapter 40. That's on page 599 in the Bibles that are scattered throughout the chairs. We're going to read verses 6 through 8. A voice says, "Cry." And I said, "What shall I cry? All flesh is grass, and all its beauty is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades when the breath of the Lord blows on it. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever." Our New Testament reading starts in the book of Matthew, chapter 26. We're going to read verses 1 through 46. That's on page 831 in the Bible scattered throughout. When Jesus had finished all these sayings, he said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified." Then the chief priests and the elders of the people gathered in the palace of the high priest, whose name was Caiaphas, and plotted together in order to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him. But they said, "Not during the feast, lest there be an uproar among the people." Now when Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, a woman came up to him with an alabaster flask of very expensive ointment, and she poured it on his head as he reclined at table. And when the disciples saw it, they were indignant, saying, "Why this waste? For this could have been sold for a large sum and given to the poor." But Jesus said to me, "For you always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me. In pouring this ointment on my body, she has done it to prepare me for burial. Truly I say to you, wherever this gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her." Then one of the 12, whose name was Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, "What will you give me if I deliver him over to you?" And they paid him 30 pieces of silver. And from that moment, he sought an opportunity to betray him. Now on the first day of the unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Where will you have us prepare for you to eat the Passover?" He said, "Go into the city to a certain man and say to him, 'The teacher says, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples.'" And the disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover. When it was evening, he reclined at table with the 12. And as they were eating, he said, "Truly I say to you, one of you will betray me." And they were very sorrowful and began to say to him one after another, "Is it I, Lord?" He answered, "He who has dipped his hand in the dish with me will betray me. The Son of Man goes as it is written of him. But woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that man if he had not been born." Judas, who would betray him, answered, "Is it I, Rabbi?" He said to him, "You have said so." Now as they were eating, Jesus took bread, and after blessing it, broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink of it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will not drink again of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom." And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Then Jesus said to them, "You will all fall away because of me this night. For it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered.' But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter answered him, "Though they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away." And Jesus said to him, "Truly I tell you, this very night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me 3 times. Peter said to him, "Even if I must die with you, I will not deny you." And all the disciples said the same. Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And taking with him Peter and the 2 sons, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me." And going a little farther, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, "Not as I will, but as you will." And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "So could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." Again, for the second time, he went away and prayed, "My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done." And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words again. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, "Sleep and take your rest later on. See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks, Tyler. Trust God's why you got to be so good. I was really hoping this is going to be a Sunday that you guys just forgot everything and made it easier for us to send you off. One of the things I love about how the Trust Gods have led music for us is the way in which they can capture the theme of the passage that we'll be preaching on, even with very little information from me about how I'm going to be preaching it. But I think you've already heard a lot of what I'm going to say this morning and sung it even, so you're well prepared for this word. But I need your help as we get started. I had like a weird experience preparing this sermon, like something that should have been very simple for me. I couldn't figure it out. I need an example of magic potion. Does anybody have an example of from literature or a movie of a magic potion?
Harry Potter.
Okay, what I haven't read them or seen them. So what's the Harry Potter? What's the potion in Harry Potter?
Polyjuice.
Okay, what does it do? Okay, interesting. Okay, so polyjuice transforms you to look like a different person. Any other examples of magic potion? None? There are so many others. I felt like this should be an easily accessible example, and I couldn't think of them.
Alice in Wonderland.
What is that potion?
You shrink and then you get
big. Oh, right. Okay, yeah, that's right. She drinks it, and she shrinks, and then you can get bigger, too, if you drink. Yeah, right. The mushrooms?
Yeah.
Like LSD and like... Oh, Alice in Wonderland. Okay, yeah, right. The mushrooms that make you shrink. Okay, not the other kind of mushrooms, but maybe it's based on. Usually not how I open up a sermon. So we have this idea of magic potion. Maybe you have your own magic potions at home, right? Your face cream that keeps your skin looking young, or your shampoo that keeps your hair all healthy and fresh. Maybe your protein shake with grass and all kinds of other stuff in it that's supposed to keep you stronger longer. We all have this idea of magic potion, right? And we all want a magic potion, something that's going to make us stay young forever, get stronger, stay sharp mentally. This morning, Jesus introduces us to this idea of a magic potion. The magic potion that we need to have in order to faithfully endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world. You see, the last few weeks we've been hearing Jesus talk kind of from a 30,000-foot view about the kingdom of this world and the nature of the kingdom of this world. And most fundamentally, the nature of the kingdom of this world, he's described, is a crumbling kingdom. That ultimately it's falling apart and it's making way for his coming kingdom that will be everlasting. A couple of weeks ago, we looked at the threats to our faithful waiting. As we wait on Christ's coming kingdom, there are threats to our waiting faithfully. We observe that even God's grace to us can be a threat to our faithful waiting. If we don't use it properly, but if we misuse God's grace, or we neglect God's grace, or we hate Christ, hide God's grace. It can be a threat to our faithful waiting as we await Christ's coming kingdom and endure this crumbling kingdom. This week, I believe that Matthew tells us a few stories to highlight the power that we need to endure the crumbling kingdom of this world, to faithfully wait on Christ's coming kingdom. We move from the threats now to our faithful waiting to the power that empowers our faithful waiting. So this morning, we're going to look at three false sources of power, one true source of power, and then we're going to look at how we participate in that power and how we respond to that power, or how we experience that power and how we express that power. First, three false sources of power. I feel like I haven't used enough sports analogies this summer, and it's baseball season. That's because the Braves have been really bad, so I don't really want to talk about them. One of the reasons that the Atlanta Braves were bad this year is that one of their kind of main players that they got this year, early in the season, got suspended for using performance-enhancing drugs. Okay, so he had been taking some sort of supplement that was not allowed by the Major League Baseball that was to make him more powerful. But this was a false source of power. This guy didn't actually have the power within himself to be the kind of hitter that he needed to be, and so he took illegal supplements to try to make himself stronger. Now, I don't know if any of you are taking PEDs this morning. It doesn't look like it, but maybe you are. But I do think that each one of us is regularly drawing on false sources of power to help us to endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world. What are the PEDs that we might be taking to help us endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world? First, I think some of us might be drawing on tradition or institutional power. And again, we've heard Jesus warn against this over and over and over again in the book of Matthew. And now we see its ultimate effect. You see, the chief priests and the elders of the temple, they had gotten together at this point to decide how they were going to kill Jesus. Throughout the whole book of Matthew, we've seen this group. Usually they're described as Pharisees or Sadducees. These are religious leaders, and often they're on opposite sides of the aisle on various issues. But on Jesus, they're united. They unite. They have to absolutely destroy Jesus. Why? Well, the last time that we saw Jesus interacting with these individuals, he was condemning the temple. He was saying the place of their institutional power was no more, that it had to be done away with. He was inviting people almost to rebel against the institutional authority that these individuals had, that they had placed their hope in. They had found a way to endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world, and that was through the institutional power of the temple. This traditional power, the tradition of the temple had been for so long an institutional power in the life of the people, and these leaders had drawn on that to help them endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world. Some of us, we might benefit from this type of institutional power. Maybe not like actual institutional leaders, but we all have institutions in our lives that we draw on to help us to endure the crumbling kingdom of this world. Think about the institution of family. This is a good institution given to us by God. But when we cling to this as the way in which we can endure the crumbling kingdom of this world, it's ultimately going to fail us. You can think about other institutional realities in your life. Maybe just characteristics or parts of you that are essential to who you are that you cling to give you power to endure life in this world. Maybe it's your job. Maybe it's a place of community for you, some place that you're clinging to. Again, these aren't all bad things. Institutions are given to us by God. And yet, if we look to those ultimately to give us the power to endure life in this crumbling kingdom of this world, Jesus says it's ultimately all going to fall apart. Because these institutions, they're all part of the crumbling kingdom. And so in a sense, as we cling to those, it's as if we're clinging to rocks that are falling, clinging to crumbs that are crumbling. Family, work, finances, homes. These institutions are good, but they're not ultimate, and they will ultimately fail us. And we may ultimately hurt others and abandon Jesus, as the chief priests and the elders do here. If we cling to these institutions as ultimate, hoping that they'll give us the power to endure life in a crumbling kingdom. Perhaps maybe on the other side of the coin here, on the opposite side of the aisle, we see another false power is the power of progress. See this in verses 6 to 16. We get to this heartbreaking moment where one of Jesus' 12 friends, best friends, decides to betray him. He goes to the authorities, these religious authorities who had just decided that they were going to kill Jesus, and he comes and provides them with the opportunity, offers to hand his good friend over to them. How do we get here? I think we can see this in the scene that comes right before Judas approaches the leaders. And in this scene, where this woman comes into the room and anoints Jesus with oil, we see two instances of Jesus kind of rejecting the progress of life in this world. First, we see this because Jesus elevates himself over the poor. Now, this is honestly kind of a confusing moment where this woman, she pours expensive oil over Jesus, and his disciples are actually furious because they say that this could have been used to help the poor. And if we've been hearing Jesus as he's been preaching, we might be tempted to agree with them. Because if you remember in the last sermon that Jesus preached, he said that one of the primary ways that we will be judged is in how we care for the poor. And so we might want to join with the disciples here and say, yeah, Jesus, she should have used this to take care of the poor, and perhaps she could have. But Jesus doesn't condemn her here, but in fact, he blesses her. Why? He says, you're always going to have the poor with you, but you won't always have me. And so he names this reality that in the crumbling kingdom of this world, poverty is a part of the crumbling kingdom. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to alleviate it as much as possible. He commends us to do that. But we ought not to elevate alleviation of poverty or any type of progress in this world over worship of God. That is the ultimate reality. All else is a part of the crumbling kingdom of this world. It's good to pursue progress. It's good to alleviate poverty. But these things don't have ultimate power to enable us to endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world. As much progress as we could possibly make is not going to overcome the fact that this kingdom is crumbling. So that's the first thing I think that Jesus says that offends Judas, this reality that poverty is not going to be alleviated in this crumbling kingdom. But then secondly, Jesus definitively says he is going to die. This is the kind of final nail in the coffin for Judas, pun intended. Tough crowd. Jesus commends this woman because he says she is preparing him for burial. You see, Jesus has predicted his death multiple times throughout the book of Matthew, but here in just the span of a few verses, first he says he's going to be delivered up to be crucified, and now he finally says really he is going to die, that it is imminent. This woman is preparing him to be buried. He's actually going to die. He's not pursuing progress according to this life. He's not going to seek to preserve his life above all else. And Judas can't take it. It's the final straw. You see, I believe that Judas is valuing progress. Preservation and progression of this life and this world above all else. If we could just resist death, if we could just alleviate poverty, if we could just pursue life and health and wealth, then we can endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world. But Jesus says, no, this is not our ultimate hope. These are good things, but they aren't ultimate things. And clinging to them would again be like clinging to crumbs in a crumbling kingdom, clinging to a falling rock. All right, so if we can't look back to traditional institutions to give us power, if we can't look forward to the progress of this life, where else might we look? Well, the next place that we see the disciples look is they look down or they look in at themselves. So we can't look ahead to progress. We can't look behind tradition. Maybe we will look into ourselves. After they eat supper with Jesus, they head outside together, and Jesus tells them that they are all going to end up abandoning him. But Peter, of course, we've seen him over and over again throughout the book of Matthew, eager to speak, jumps up and says, not me. And then he throws all of his buddies under the bus. Did you notice that? He says, all of them, they probably will. I could see that. They'll probably all ditch you, Jesus, but not me. Even if I have to die with you, I have what it takes to endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world. I will do it. And all the disciples, it says, say the same. If we don't look forward, we don't look back, we're going to look at ourselves. I can do it. I have what it takes. And again, it's good for us to be industrious. Our family is watching Little House on the Prairie right now. And man, I want to be like Charles Ingalls. I never will be. But the man can overcome every single obstacle, right? And he literally pulls himself up by the bootstraps. That actually was a thing. There were straps on his boots that he pulled up. And he was able to get the job done, overcome any obstacle. And this is good. This is great. It's good to be industrious. It's good to seek to preserve yourself and others. It's good to work hard. Good to take responsibility for yourself. But ultimately, this cannot be where our hope lies, that we have what it takes to endure the crumbling kingdom of this world. If this is our ultimate hope, we will not make it. If we think to ourselves like the disciples did, Jesus, it's good to have you nearby, but I can do this. We sit in church and we listen to sermons and we think of all the other people that this applies to because I'm doing pretty good. This is a precarious place for us to be. It's not a way to endure the crumbling kingdom of this world. It's clinging to crumbs. And we cannot be empowered to wait on the coming kingdom, to endure the crumbling kingdom while we are clinging to the crumbs that are crumbling. So where must we look? We can't look back. We can't look forward. We can't look in. We have to look up to the one true source of power. You see, right in the middle of this passage, Jesus shows us where the power to endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world comes from. It comes from God himself. It's offered to us in the person of Jesus. You see, Jesus is the one who is outside of, above the crumbling kingdom of this world, and yet he entered into it for the sake of you and me. That's what's pictured here at the Lord's Supper that Jesus institutes in our reading today. It's why we participate in the Lord's Supper week after week after week. Because it's here that we receive, by faith, the power that we need to endure the crumbling kingdom of this world. We are empowered by this table because it's at this table that Jesus Christ himself offers us himself. First, he says, as he breaks the bread, "This is my body." And it's here that Jesus envisions and symbolizes the giving of his life for ours. You see, Jesus was the only one who perfectly endured life in the crumbling kingdom of this world, never clinging to the crumbs, but endured perfectly, waited perfectly on the coming kingdom of God. And he offers us his life, his perfect waiting for our false waiting, his perfect waiting for our clinging to false powers. He offers us his body. He offers us his life. And then he pours out the cup, the wine. He says, "This is a new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for the forgiveness of sins." Here it's pictured that Jesus offers us his death. Because as we've seen over the last few weeks, this not perfectly waiting, it's not an amoral thing with no ultimate implications for us, but our not faithful waiting, our clinging to false powers in this world, it offends God. And so we deserve to be punished for that. If we're clinging to falling rock, we are going to get crushed. That's the reality that Jesus has been trying to bring before us time and time again. And yet the good news here is Jesus envisions as he pours out the wine is that he is going to take that for us. He was crushed, as we heard in our offer of forgiveness, so that we don't have to be. His death for ours, that we might be forgiven. Jesus offers us his life and his death. His success for our failure, his death for our punishment. This is the magic potion that enables us to endure life in the crumbling kingdom. And yet that's a bit of a misnomer because there's nothing intrinsically magical about the bread and the wine. But the magic is in not just the potion, but in how we receive it and how we respond to it. So how do we experience that power? How do we receive this power? I believe there's three things that we must do to experience the power to endure that Christ offers us in himself. First, there are going to be three R's. The first one, we must reflect. We see this moment just before Jesus offers the disciples this power. He invites them to name their need for it. He says that one of them is going to betray him. And he doesn't name which one of them it is. In every single one of them, it seems like they go one by one by one. They actually think it's them. Could it be me? Is it me? You see, they recognize that they could, even though Peter has all this bravado, he knows he doesn't actually have the power. And he names that. They feel their weakness in this moment. They see that they have it within themselves, that they might be the betrayer. And so I believe that the first step to experiencing the power of God's grace through Jesus Christ is to realize that we need it. It's why we do a moment of confession every single week, to give us a chance to reflect on ways in which we have become the betrayer. We all ought to have heard the sermon from a couple of weeks ago and said, maybe I could be a goat instead of a sheep. God, is that me? I could be capable of abandoning everything I say I believe if I find something better. We all ought to have heard the first point of the sermon today and thought, which of these false powers do I cling to? Is it me? Am I doing that? We must be willing and able to do this self-examination. And notice that Christ invites us to do that. Christ initiates this moment. Christ tells you, one of you is a betrayer. Christ invites you to do this reflection and self-examination. This is a safe place to name that, to name ways in which we're clinging to false powers in the world, to name and confess our sins to God and to one another. Christ invites us. He invites us to reflect. And then secondly, he invites us to receive. Jesus instructs his disciples what to do. Take and eat. Drink of it, all of you. He doesn't just generally say, here I am, do with me what you want. But he instructs them to receive him. Friends, after doing an honest self-examination, Jesus' life, we would then realize there's nothing that we can do to attain to Jesus' life. And so there's no instruction or action here except to receive. And ultimately, we receive this by faith. You see, the potion doesn't have any magic on its own. The magic is made when we receive it by faith. When after self-reflection, we realize we don't have what it takes, and so we need power from outside of ourselves. And we believe that power is offered to us by Jesus, and we receive it by faith. Then thirdly and finally, the way that we experience the power of God that's offered to us is by a proper response. We reflect, we receive, and then we respond. There's only one person in this whole passage, aside from Jesus, who's spoken positively of. And it's this woman. This, frankly, scandalous, awkward, maybe even foolish woman. You see, it would have been scandalous for her to even walk in this room with 13 men who were eating dinner, and she walks in, scandalous. And then she pours thousands of dollars of oil on Jesus' head. And this is awkward. Like, we might think that there's some cultural gap here, that this is like a normal thing to do. It wasn't. This was an odd thing to happen while a bunch of guys are sitting around eating supper. She's scandalous. She's awkward. And then she's ultimately foolish. I mean, this is probably about $4,000 worth of oil, ointment, that she pours on Jesus' head. This was probably her life savings. And she gives it all up. And Jesus blesses her. Why? Because this is the proper response. As we reflect and we realize we don't have anything in ourselves to endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world, as we receive God's grace through Jesus Christ, then we respond by offering him everything. This is the only proper response, full and ultimate devotion to Jesus Christ. Being willing and able to give up everything for him. You see, you can't have just like a little bit of PEDs, a little bit of performance-enhancing drugs and get by. You either take it or you don't. You can't have a little bit of the false power of the crumbling kingdom of this world and a little bit of Jesus. It doesn't work that way. He asks us to give it all up. And does that actually mean that you give away your business, you give away your life, you abandon your family? No. Not necessarily. Certainly you don't abandon your family. We're called to be faithful to those gifts that God has given us, but not as ultimate things. We ought to be laying them down at Jesus' feet and asking him to tell us what to do with them, that we might be faithful to them, not clinging to them to give us the power that only he can give us to endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world. This woman has forsaken all that she has in this world. She gave it up for the sake of loving and following Jesus, and we must do the same. This is absolutely essential as reflecting and receiving is responding. We must be willing to give up everything for the sake of being faithful to Jesus. This is the only way that we might experience the power that Christ offers us. Otherwise, as we're clinging to these false powers, it's going to rob us of the true power that Jesus offers us. So that's how we experience the power. But now, how do we express that power? Like, what does this actually empower us to do? Does it empower us to look like somebody else or to get small or big? Does it empower us to overcome all the crumbling of this kingdom? Does it empower us to transcend all the pain and suffering in this world? It doesn't, actually. This is the most surprising point, I believe, that we'll see this morning, is what the power of Christ that's offered to us empowers us to do. How do we express this power? As we're drawing on the power of Christ, I believe that it enables us to endure the crumbling kingdom of this world in the same way that he did. So how does Jesus endure the crumbling kingdom of this world? We see this in verses 36 to 46, the end of our reading today. I'd invite you to turn there if you haven't already. I don't have quippy, you know, rhyming points or alliterative points for this, but we're just going to observe together. How does Jesus endure the crumbling kingdom of this world? What does the power of God empower him to do? First, it empowers him to ask for help. Three times we see him in this passage, asking for help. Jesus, the God of the universe, asking for help from a bunch of frankly weak and disappointing friends. He asks them to come with him while he prays, to stay with him, to be near to him, to comfort him. He's drawing on the power of God. And what does that power enable him to do? Ask for help. Probably not something that you want the power of God to enable you to do, right? We all would love to draw on the power of God that would enable us to never need help from anybody again. But even Jesus needed help from his friends. So that's the first thing, that as we're trying to endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world, God empowers us to overcome our pride and our individualism and ask for help from our friends, even our weak and disappointing friends. Secondly, all right, Jesus is drawing on the power of God to endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world. And what does he do? He grieves. Verse 37 says that Jesus was sorrowful and troubled. And frankly, those words don't really do justice to the depth of feeling that the original Greek language is trying to communicate. Maybe a better translation would be he was depressed and disoriented. One commentator writes that these words are used of a man who is rendered helpless, disoriented, who is agitated and anguished. Jesus is grieving, feeling the depth and breadth of human emotion here. Again, probably not something that you want the power of God to enable you to do. I would love the power of God to enable me to just endure all the struggles of life in this world with a smile on my face, never really feeling any of it. But no. The power of God enables Jesus to grieve the crumbling kingdom of this world. He sees that he's about to die, and he's not excited about it. But he's depressed and disoriented. Thirdly, he draws on the power of God to what? To name his grief. Again, it's hard enough to feel the feelings and the brokenness of this world, but now Jesus says it out loud. Jesus is basically saying here in verse 38, I'm so sad, I feel like I could die. He's heartbroken. If you're anything like me, your reaction might be, okay, Jesus, don't be so dramatic. But have you ever felt this way? Have you ever told somebody or thought to yourself, like, I am so heartbroken right now, I feel like I could just die? Friends, let me tell you, Jesus has felt that way. Jesus feels that with you, and God's power is offered to us that we might feel that and even have the guts to name it out loud. He does that even to God. That's the other thing that God's power enables him to do, is to talk openly with God. Three times Jesus prays the same two things. The first thing he says is, God, I really don't want to do this. God, I really don't want to endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world. Jesus says that. If there's any other way to do this, God, can we do it a different way? It's the first thing he says. Then secondly, he says, but ultimately, I want to wait faithfully on your kingdom. Ultimately, God, I want what you want. So help me to do what you want me to do. This is Jesus talking openly with God about the nature of the crumbling kingdom of this world. I think most of us, if we're Christians here, we get that second prayer request, and we do that often. God, help me to live life the way that you want me to live it. But how often do we do that first part? Name to God, I really don't want to endure what you're calling me to endure. This is what God's power offered to us in Jesus Christ enables us to do. This is how we endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world. We talk openly with God about our experience. And then, this is the fifth thing he does. He confronts his friends. His friends fail him every single time. And God's power offered to him enables him to tell them, hey, you disappointed me. That was disappointing. See, friends, I wish I could tell you that the power of God offered to us as we together draw on that as a church, it makes us live together in perfect utopian unity, that we never disappoint each other, that we never let ourselves or each other or other people down. But man, we do. If you're visiting here this morning, I want to tell you that we're not a perfect community, but we continue to draw on the grace of God to try to grow together, to name our disappointment lovingly to one another and graciously to one another, even as Jesus does. This helps us to endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world. And then finally, the sixth thing that Jesus does, he draws on the power of God to do five things that probably none of us want to do before he does this final thing, which is to resolutely face reality. Finally, in verse 46, he says, rise, let us be going. This is the sixth and final thing that Jesus does with the power of God. He's asked his friends for help. He's grieved. He's named his grief. He's prayed for some other way. He's confronted his disappointing friends. And only now is he ready to resolutely face the reality of life in the crumbling kingdom of this world. Ultimately, Jesus is able to endure life in the crumbling kingdom here, not because he's empowered to transcend it, but because he's empowered to go through it, all of it. And we can too. This is what he invites us into, is to endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world, go through it, not to transcend it. I know that many of you, you are in seasons where you're acutely feeling the crumbs falling all around you. Maybe things that you had clinged to that are just falling and breaking. Bodies breaking down. Relationships breaking down. Family breaking down. Business breaking down. All the crumbs of this kingdom coming down around you. I want to tell you that Christianity doesn't invite you just to ignore it and transcend all above it, but to walk through it. Invite you to do that with a community, not a perfect community, but one that together is seeking to endure life in the crumbling kingdom of this world. I want to invite you to draw on Jesus' power, to resolutely face whatever might come. But even that resolution might not come until a long season of sadness and grief passes, a lot of disappointment, a lot of agonizing prayer, and we want to be with you in that. Jesus is with you in that. We can stay the course by only the grace of God that's offered to us in Jesus Christ. To that end, would you pray with me? God, I pray that you would even now just bring to mind spaces in which we are just clinging to crumbs. I know I do. My heart is so drawn to I just want to set up a nice, easy life for myself. God, it's hard to endure the crumbling kingdom of this world as things around us seem to be falling apart. For those of us who are feeling the crumbling kingdom acutely right now, I pray for comfort, God. I pray for the power to endure as you endured, Jesus. For those of us who maybe aren't feeling the crumbling of this kingdom, I pray that you would open our eyes to the ways in which all that we're clinging to ultimately will fall apart, that only you stand forever, Jesus, and will we draw on your power to faithfully wait on your coming kingdom. We pray these things in your name. Amen.